I'm Jag Valesky. I'm an investor. And I'm not panicked about anything right now.
Ethan.
Howie.
What is your title this week?
I'm still chief of staff.
He's chief of staff, Knut.
Yes, he is.
It's like the longest running chief of staff at Crimerica. Actually, there's another Crimerica on the show today. I'm looking through his bio, and he started Crimerica as well. So we're going to have a lawsuit, it looks like, with our guest coming up. You are in for a treat. I don't know, Knut, you've met Judd maybe at Palooza's?
We might have you at some point.
Yeah, Judd's one of the smartest people I know.
And you know that's willing to talk to me.
I know a lot of smart people that just don't return my call. Judd returns my call. So I continue to call him. So funny, I wanted him on the pod. I was, we have the same taste, and I'm full of taste. So Judd surprisingly has taste. And I'm taking in cheap shots before he has a chance to get on here. And we just spent two fun days catching up with, he caught up with Ellen and some friends. He was visiting New York, checking out spots for his kids. And we ran into each other. I was at the Crosby having breakfast. He walked in for a meeting. Oh, Judd, we don't plan to run into each other in places like this. He's a Boulder, I'm Phoenix. And I'd just come off a long road trip. And we were chatting and I told him my daughter lives on the Upper East Side. He said, you got to go check out the Lowell. Listen, Judd and I know each other well. I trust Judd. Judd is a traveler and likes certain things just like I like certain things, just so. And I trusted him, and we had a great time. Had a great catch-up. We sat in the lobby, watched some weird Upper East things going on, which was fun, very different to have locals versus just the hoity-poity Soho people. So I really enjoyed the quiet of it.
Cool.
And I said, Judd, come on the pod. And Judd goes, I have nothing to talk about. I'm very wealthy, very confident in my own skin. You do a podcast? And that was when I said, you have to come on if you don't even know I do one. And he knows so much about the world. He's an engineer, I think, by trade, back when engineers used fingers. Now it's just AI, and they tell the computer subconsciously what to do. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about one of the great companies at Web2 that was built, which is Gnip, which was a social data analytics company out in Boulder, which was acquired by Twitter and probably destroyed, but was the biggest business arm, as Stocktwits knows from having our data. Gnip, he'll walk you through the product. Great name, Ping spelled backwards, which was part of the brand. And I remember succinctly going to meet his partner, not Judd, in Boulder. And, you know, as Howard does, he just storms in an office. This is the way the web used to work when people weren't greedy and thinking they were geniuses. They had just a piece of paper on their office door that said Gnip. Just a piece of tape with Gnip. And I charge him. I go, where's Eric? And he goes, Eric's having lunch. I go, who are you? He goes, co-founder. I said, well, fuck Eric. We're now friends. And we've stayed friends ever since. Gone hiking and all over the place.
Awesome.
Anyways. And he is panicked about nothing, which is important because, and by the way, he also was early on at Honey, which was acquired for, I don't know, $100 billion by PayPal. And Judd's also an LP in our fund. He was CFO at Techstars for a drink or two, for a coffee, and obviously huge on the Boulder tech scene, but, you know, out of the limelight. So let's bring on Judd. Judd, you're on.
Hey, good to see and hear you.
Yeah, are you back in Boulder?
Back in Boulder for a little bit. Loving it.
So tech. I want to talk about tech with you because you're probably... Well, first of all, you're not panicked. Explain to me when we asked a million guests, what are they panicked about? And I like your answer. Only a few guests have said they're panicked about nothing. And you said you're not panicked. So what does that mean to you?
Panic for me is when I've got something in motion that suddenly goes in a direction I had not anticipated. And I almost feel like you want to, I get the buzz factor of panic, the word. I get why you're poking on that, but to me, it's more like, what might I be worried about? Panic is a very specific thing for me. And I'm not in that state right now. I'm worried about lots of things, but I'm not panicked about anything.
Correct. There's two things to do about panic. You panic first, which means just quietly just panic before everybody else. And very few people can do that. They wait for other signal. And generally, the idea was a play on words. Like if it's, you know, generally it's too late to panic by the time you panic. So very little to control there. Worry is one thing. The country is a constant state of worry, hence the sales of drugs. This country has been packaged and sold as the worried states of America, WSA. And that's been the good sales job through all this. While we talk about what the real problems are, they've just to anxiety, heightened by, you know, people like you engineering cool toys, but no, you didn't think of that when you destroyed the world back then.
No, and that was a long time ago. I think there's a lot of folks from that era are reconsidering some of the technical and product decisions that were made.
And one of those is speed. So this is one of my favorite stories that people will enjoy. It was one of the most nerve-wracking for you back when tech was a little slower. We call it the latent era. So is it your first job at Netscape?
Yeah. So graduated University of Colorado Boulder and then shot out to Netscape Communications. Actually, the guy that hired me, I was actually just out in Palo Alto for his end of life service. He just recently passed, but anyway, he came out to Boulder University, did some interviewing, and brought me to Netscape, and I graduated here and landed there.
And were you brought up because it was just a job, or did you know that that was kind of like a movement?
I had a sense that it was a movement. You know, I was interviewing with a handful of different companies, different styles, different approaches to business, and that interviewing scenario was actually quite interesting. There were two companies in Palo Alto that I was considering. One of them was Anderson Consulting before it flipped into Accenture. And I made it all the way through that process. And I was having dinner. It was kind of a celebratory dinner with a bunch of the candidates at Blue Chunk Palo Alto. And I kind of leaned back. There were maybe 20, 30 of us kids around the table and couple of partners trying to do the final sales pitch, and kind of leaned back at one point. I was like, man, these are not my people. You know, this is not, this is not my table. And, you know, I think the next week I went out for the on-site interviews at Netscape, and we went out for lunch, and, you know, we went to some Japanese hole in the wall joint and had some awesome food with some awesome people, and went away from that experience thinking, yeah, these are my people. This is happening.
Yes. Tech wasn't cool. This was the beginning of the interface, much like people in crypto are waiting for the killer app. Netscape became the killer app for the internet.
Yeah. No, it was not cool yet, but it was right at that moment. You know, Netscape was the first $1 billion software IPO to ever happen. And I landed right after that. I was not there pre-IPO, but was there just after, and that was my whole kind of career launch experience was with that crew, and specifically the networking library group at Netscape.
So maybe other than the penis Zoom episode, so let's talk, because penis episode on Zoom was the peak of Zoom stock. You had an email non-penis altercation.
Yes.
That was just, the world today would be very different. But your life would be very different if the internet was as fast or if servers worked the same way as they did in 1999 as they do today. So tell me the mood of the company. You guys go public, Andreessen's becoming famous, and tell me what's going on in the bullpen there.
Yeah, so, you know, bullpen, you know, I'm low-level intro engineer at the company. Yeah. And Andreessen, you know, brilliant guy, had written a lot of great software. But at this moment in time, IPO, management track, was kind of ascending the ranks, you know, and wound up with pointy hair, as Dilbert would say, and was clearly in upper management. And kind of, as anyone would, became a little bit detached from the underlying engineering team. As a result of all of that, in good fun and just the original engineering team, which I got bolted onto the side of. I was not an original engineer there. They had this email group where they would poke kind of gleeful fun at Andreessen when media would pick him up on something. And, you know, he'd get a media headshot and it would get posted in this publication or that publication. And folks...
Pre-Slack.
And every time there was a new publication, someone would throw a gentle rock into the private email group list just to kind of poke fun at their buddy that had been taken over by the management board. And one day I got into the office particularly early and I caught some media publication that had just published something with him and there was a headshot. And I thought I would be cool and, you know, trying to get to know the group and become one of the crew. I thought it'd be cool to grab that shot, post into the email group. And there was some quip, you know, I made some quip about, hey, we're losing him even further down the pipe here, you know? And I thought I had come up with something cute to say and
push send,
and kind of lean back
immediate
in my chair.
Regret.
Yeah. And I lean back in my chair. I'm proud of myself. And I look at the screen and as the progress bar is cranking away, I noticed that I had addressed
Ethan, there was a progress bar, just so you know, the
email.
Internet had a progress
bar. That's right. I notice in the to field, I had addressed it to him directly.
Oh, and by mistake.
By mistake. You know, subconsciously, I had sent it to him instead of the email group. And I lunge forward, smash the keyboard, throw the monitor out of the way, like just trying to get to some cable to try to interrupt what's going on. And before I could do that, sure enough, it was sent. And this is my first job out of college. I'm navigating life. I don't know what's happening in the world, but I know I had just made a serious mistake.
Yeah, fundamental error.
Fundamental error. And, you know, the email didn't say anything terrible, but it was clearly mocking and joking multiple levels up, my boss, right? Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I'm panicked, right? Something I had sent in motion went in a direction I did not anticipate it going. And yeah. I'm flipping out, grab the phone, call a buddy in IT that I happen to know, you know, worked with. I think at that time we were using Microsoft Exchange. Got him on the phone. I said, hey, man, I got a weird question. Are you able to go in and delete a message out of someone's box?
It's like a modern Seinfeld episode with the voicemail.
Full on. That's right. It would have been trying to get the
tape out. Taking the tape out of the voice recording machine.
And he's silent. And then he's like, dude, do not ask me to do that. Like, I don't know what rules we would be violating, but a lot of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, I'm not asking you to do it. I'm just wondering if it's technically possible. And he's like, yeah, it's technically possible. And I said, thank you. And we hung up. So I'm kind of mulling over, my God, do I actually ask him to do something like this? Who knows if he would have even done it? Tried to figure that out. I'm panicking. And we had these PBX phone systems at the time. And my phone rings and caller ID says a Marka on it, Mark Andreessen. And I'm like, oh my God, here we go. More panic. And watching my life flash before my eyes, I grab the phone. I say, hey, this is Judd. And there's a woman on the other end. And she says, Judd, this is so-and-so. I'm Mark's admin. And I just got an email here. And I screen his emails just to filter down for him. And I just want to be sure you want me to forward this on to him before I do so. Because I'm not sure this is the kind of email you'd necessarily do that with. And I said, please don't forward that email. It was sent by mistake. And at this point, she's chuckling. And she said,
Today that would have been on Twitter and
it would have been over.
You would be in Russia.
That's right. That's right.
So you were spared by latency.
Latency. That's right. Yeah. Baked in
so
latency.
Any advice for your kids today based on what happened? See, the thing, the kids don't get to make these type of mistakes. The world just is moving at such a fast pace. So I mean, well, you got lucky. She was a wonderful lady. Yes. She obviously was doing her job. She spared Mark a big headache. Like, in the end, she did her job. Like, Mark wouldn't have been happy to see them. No, of course not. Was a waste of time.
Totally. And I did send her flowers the next day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, advice today is, one, don't use social media. Two, if you're using email or, you know, any tense interaction, you just got to pull the 24-hour rule, right? Draft it.
Send it to yourself.
And see how it feels in the light of the next day.
Yeah. What I generally do is just, I pick on one person, I send them everything. So it's just someone I dislike and they read every thought that's in my head. It's kind of like my poison account. Somehow goes, why is Howard sending me this? Why has he got a beef with this guy? But anyways, I think that's good advice. Like, kids just don't understand.
You didn't understand
what you were doing, and you were saved by a great assistant who was saving both Mark and you aggravation, keeping productivity going. I think one thing there is, as many layers as there were, the world was way more productive at some level. You know,
yeah.
Like, think about all the time wasted on social with people just going, I wish I didn't say that.
100%.
So did you make a little money at Netscape, or did you move right on?
It did fine. You know, I had a stock grant. It wasn't pre-IPO, but it was a decent grant and, you know, did well.
And so, Ginnip, now we go to Web 2. This is where you and I became friends. You know, I got into the social media. I just got the fever. Right? You know, I'm not a tech guy. So YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn started making sense to me. So I went all in. For you, what got you excited? What made you start getting it?
Well, around that time.
This is 2007, 8?
6-ish. I think it was six-ish. Yeah. You know, around that time, MySpaces of the world were a thing, and Facebook was a thing, and Twitter was trying to figure out how to come online. And this idea that social media was going to become something big was becoming apparent. And we resolved there would undoubtedly be commercial value in that public environment, in that public discussion environment. We didn't know exactly where the value would be, but it was kind of the beginning of what marketing had always wanted, which was insight into what people are generally thinking in real time. That was always the holy grail for marketing, and social media was walking down that path. So we resolved we wanted to figure some commercial value out in social media. And it didn't wind up being exactly where we thought it would be at first, which is the case.
Right, it was a grind.
It was absolutely a grind. It took years to figure something out. But we figured it out, and, you know, it's very obvious now, but there was absolute commercial value in public social forums, and we were aggregating that from lots of different sources and packaging it up and cleaning it up and providing it in a low latent manner to commercial interests, and we built a business around that. You could not build that business today in the era.
Why? No one would let you?
Yeah, no one would let you now. And it was horribly abused. You know, I stand by our values, our principles, our morals. When we built that business all the way through, we did it the right way, but there were lots of players in that space that did it the wrong way.
Non-legally.
Non-legally, against terms of use, terms of service. Yeah. In some cases, flagrant privacy violation dynamics, Cambridge Analytica being the poster child of that with Facebook.
Right.
And after that whole episode, social data in general as a business completely changed, turned into something else.
So let's walk through it. We were all kind of in the Twitter ecosystem, or I guess Facebook, like, it depended on which ecosystem, but it was Twitter or Facebook, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Facebook was a lot more consistent in the way they behaved after, you know, early blunders, meaning they're just evil. And Twitter was just the, everybody's got bird seeds and balloons, and CEO, product person changed every week, CEO changed every week. why was it not obvious to Twitter for so long that this is the business that they should be in? And now today still aren't. But what was the switch? When they, like, how do you think that all came down?
Good question. They understood there was commercial value for quite a long time. They had staffed a small team internally to try to address that commercial value. We just put more resources into it is the way I would talk about it. And we ground out a large business over multiple years and stayed. They were a critical and close partner of ours. So they had visibility, a lot of good visibility into our business. And they watched that grow with us. You know, the beauty of a strong partnership is folks get to see how the underlying business is functioning. And we were so focused and dedicated to it. They could see the size of it and the continued growth of it. And we had dedicated ourselves to it. So in the end, it was, hey, let's buy these guys. They've got the whole industry dialed at this point. So let's absorb it.
Well, they bought you. They bought my other friend, Jim Payne, MoPub. And now we look today and there's no MoPub and Elon's kind of fired everybody at Gannett. But when Gannett was acquired, what was kind of the run rate around?
I think we were 50-ish million, 40, 50 million a year.
What was peak revenue at Gannett? Did it get to 500 million-ish
around that. I mean, the business expanded in a couple of different vectors to get there. But whole dollars aside, we were at acquisition time all the way to the end, the most profitable group in the company by far away. So in terms of,
and high margin,
sorry, that's what I'm saying. Not, the ad business always brought in the most whole dollars, right. But by margin, we crushed it.
And by truly what Twitter is, if you wanted to really keep Twitter pure, you don't need ads. You just run a lean organization around the data. So what do you think Elon's play here? Not that you care, you don't work there. You don't own stock. I guess you say you're not really into social media anymore, but maybe you read stuff. Like for me, we talked about it recently. I was like, he bought it just for himself.
Right. A platform for himself. Yeah. I certainly can't speak to that. You know, I can,
right.
he nuked not everyone, but just about everyone with Gannett, when he came onto the scene, recently tried to reconstitute the basic product offering with new price points. And I have no idea how that business is going. You know,
I'm hearing laughs from the audience.
Yeah, you may, right? It's I do one thing that certainly stood out was some of the price points were $250,000 a month for some of the products we were building. And we would have loved to have been charging that, of course.
Yeah.
And in some cases, we certainly were. But to generalize the product offering at those price points, I don't know what the market will bear. He's learning right now as we speak. And maybe it's working.
And the few people that got excited have already killed the business idea. So everybody moves on, right? Like, if you can't drink from the fire hose, you move on.
Yeah.
So it's the most fascinating company. You chose it in many ways as a derivative to play it through Gannett. So I think all the smartest people, whether it's Fred Wilson or you or Brett, like were around it because it's the Nile River. It was the digital Nile River. It was just a protocol that everything was flowing through, good, bad, ugly, evil. And it's a mystery. Still a mystery. Can cause blindness if you get too close to it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You know, my general antisocial headspace is more a commentary on the world being ad-driven these days. You know, pick your Web2 product offering other than SaaS-related stuff. And at the core is a CPM ad rate. And I forget, somebody just published a book called Traffic, as reading a synopsis of. And, you know, therein lies the demise of Web2. Everything was distilled down to an ad impression.
Ad impression and ZERP, you know, when we look back, we got nothing.
Yeah.
Web 2 was one of the giant misdirections of all time.
I mean,
we got the iPhone, thank God. We got the cloud. But social just doesn't matter.
A lot of power in the moment, you know, 10, 15 years of a lot of money floating around, a lot of profit generated in there, very little value.
Yeah. And so you got a good deal for yourself. You knew your expertise. You brought in a CEO near the end there who's still, Chris Moody is now a venture capitalist.
Yeah.
Was the plan to bring in someone that looked like yourself to trick investors and quietly leave?
So that was nothing.
Because you are an evil genius.
that was not conscious. In retrospect, definitely looks and feels that way.
Brilliant chess move.
I don't know if it was mine.
I used to call Chris Moody and go, nice try. And I would just talk to him like he was you. And I go, how was your weekend? He goes, who are you? I go, you're Judd Valesky. He goes, no, I'm Chris Moody. So you extricated yourself beautifully from the Twitter inner guts. And you're farting around. And what made Hunt, explain to people, because what's amazing about you, as I spend time with you and run into you around the world, is we're very similar. Even though you're a geek and I'm not a geek, we both are kind of curious people. Mm-hmm. We're all curious, or at least people that get along are curious people, and then there's people who just aren't curious, like Knut. Knut's very uncurious.
Funny.
They're used to getting money from the government. I don't blame him. He's on the dole.
God, is that wrong too now?
He's not quite French. Oh, sorry. I lost my head there. So with you, you like, let's think about it. You can't just be like a Netscape, middle of web to the dead center, whether people know Gnip or not, it was the dead center. You and I would have these conversations. I was like, Gnip is, Twitter could charge four people and make $1 billion if they really wanted to. It's, they don't have to give the pipe to anybody, but like Goldman, JP Morgan, Bloomberg, you know. So you understood all that. Then you decide to hang your hat with Honey. How does that come along? And tell people what Honey is. That was a huge thing.
So Honey, and first of all, you had, at the intro, you had introduced Honey's acquisition by PayPal at $100 billion. That is inaccurate.
But in some currency out there, it was $100 billion.
Sure.
Could be drachma.
We can build a token and apply.
What was the acquisition?
$4 billion. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And we both know Jeremy. We're LPs in his fund. Jeremy was the acquirer.
Yeah. Yep. Jeremy's a great guy. So Honey helps people save money online when they're shopping. And it does so in a meaningful manner. And that's what a lot of people don't quite understand. You know, it's pretty straightforward to save somebody a buck here or there when they're shopping online. And that's meaningful to some shoppers, for sure. But to save people, on average, dollar amounts in the tens, and to periodically have them save potentially hundreds on a purchase, that's tangible, powerful, and meaningful. And Honey did that. It was a browser extension.
Now, what was their magic? Because I still don't know what a browser extension is.
So browser extension weaves into the web browser and extends its functionality. So,
but who uses any? Do you use any, Ethan?
I do, actually. There's a new one, an AI one that I'm using, and it helps me with everything from email to just writing.
What's it called?
It is called Compose AI, not to shout them out, but...
You shut them out. So it just sits there in your browser. I use a few, but not that one. Yeah. And I never used Honey because I like paying full price. Because
there
I'm,
you go. Some,
an idiot.
Some people do. Browser extension, it's probably the most significant piece of technology to come out of Web 1.0 to never be fully utilized. And it is
like, meaning Netscape had that and they didn't know how to manage, like,
correct.
They're like a Twitter moment. They didn't monetize that.
Correct. It's even less about monetization. It's getting the industry to understand it, what extensions are and how to use them and what they can actually mean was completely and utterly overlooked by the network as we know it. It's a crying shame. But to your prior question, does anyone use extensions? Unfortunately, the answer is generally no. The extensions that do get used tend to be ad blocking extensions.
I use that.
Yeah, extensions put the consumer in control, which is very different from the internet as you view it today. It's actually the publishers who are in control. And so When the user is put in control, what do? The first thing they do is they block ads, right? So there's this...
The number one browser extension.
Exactly, exactly. And so a lot of power there, but very adversarial with respect to how the network otherwise grew up. So no one uses extensions. If you do, you have an ad blocker. If you go one level deeper, you had Honey installed.
Okay.
And
how did they rise above that noise? And obviously it had tremendous values, so it just spread like wildfire.
Long, slow grind, right? Okay. And years of no marketing, no advertising. Word of mouth, distribution, people saving money. You're at a dinner party. You just
actual providing value,
actual real tangible value to the consumer. And I get this question all the time: like, I want to do an extension. How do I do it? And there are a lot of really interesting extensions.
Well, because I send you every deck that's an extension.
Exactly. <yeah.
laughs> I go. You must get so many emails from idiots like me. Talk to Jed, Honey 6.0.
Yeah, exactly, Honey 6.0. And what every one of those extension ideas gets wrong is end user consumer value. You know, it's the compose.ai, there's actual real value in there. I hadn't heard of that one. That it's undoubtedly something I'll pick up and try out, though, because the user's getting some real AI application to the internet that they're working with. Like, there's real value there. And most companies want to do, and they want the value to magically appear out of, by virtue of just doing the extension. And it's like, no, it doesn't work that way. You have to, the extension is the thing that ultimately gives an avenue to the value for the user.
And so how did Honey build it? What was Honey's genius?
Honey's genius was in tapping into existing ad frameworks and tying that together with discount codes and users' shopping habits and behaviors. And then again, slow roll, organic growth, providing users real value, and then was poking around potential strategic partnership dynamics with PayPal, and that turned into a closer look by Jeremy and turned into an acquisition.
So you go from Netscape to selling your own company, not starting your own company, doing a stint with helping the Boulder community with Techstars to some monster company. Mm-hmm. What's the difference of all of them?
Oh gosh. Well,
any more satisfying than the last? Or is Ginnip the most satisfying because it was just
they're all satisfying in different ways, right? You know, one thing that was unique between, or that caught me off guard post Netscape was a phenomenal moment in time. It was an incredible set of people doing brilliant things that were very difficult to do. And I came out of that Netscape experience thinking that was it, which was a problem because I was in my mid-20s, right? It was, I was like, wait, you know.
But you had hair. I mean, you had everything going for you.
I had a little bit of hair.
You had a flip side of what you look like today.
There you go. and I thought coming out of that experience, I'd never relate to people. I'd never have that team camaraderie, powerful relationship dynamic in business ever again. And I went years with that cloud hanging over me. And then we fired up Ginnip. And lo and behold, you can have multiple phenomenal friendship, relationship, business, team moments across your career and your lifespan. So that was surprising to me. It was a very pleasant surprise with Ginnip. You know, it was kind of a family one was Netscape, family two was Ginnip. And similarly, Honey, you know, turned into family three. This was all surprising to me that you could have several of these phenomenally powerful life experiences in one life.
So now I want to bring up full circle to today. We were just you and I, it was meant to be that we caught up. Now, unfortunately, we talked mostly about porn and things, which is, you know, just works no matter what you're doing,
sports and pornography.
What does it feel like when you, let's just give a viewer what it feels like. You now walk in. What is the feeling when you see me at the Crosby?
My feeling is awesome, a guy I can relate to on the finance side of things that allows me to understand the blend of finance and tech in a way that I can't do on my own.
So it's not like Howard looks great. how does he do it? Why has he made me money and yet I've started three companies and not included him? Those aren't the thoughts that go through your head, not guilt. Like it's a one-way fucking street of social leverage returning capital to you and me not being involved in anything you do. There's no guilt.
I think, hey man, I'm quite certain you looked the other way.
I keyed that up for you and there was nothing in there for me.
You
some finance assholes, a finance bro.
No, it was the combination. It was the combination of finance and tech.
Yeah. Now, did you think I would go to the Lowell or were you just like,
no,
are you always surprised
not.
By
yeah,
like,
yeah, of course I did not think you would. No, whenever.
And immediately I moved my hotel to the Lowell.
Yeah, and you were better off for it.
Yeah. And so there's something to this serendipitous thing. So what is it today? You're not going to get back in the arena, as Chamath would call it. You aren't panicked about anything. There's no reason to be. You can mentor. You've got two kids going to college, right?
So my son is studying computer science up at Fordham University in New York.
Shocker.
Yeah, I know.
Shocker.
Yeah. And my daughter,
underachiever,
daughter was just admitted to FIT in New York. So we may be staring down the barrel of two kids in New York.
And then my daughters are that you got to see. So it's just fun when your kids are in New York. I mean, if you're in America, and there is no war and there is no, draft. I mean, if your kids are in New York, that is probably the highest essence of being an American is
my son.
If they're not going to make you go around the world serving people, you might as well be in New York growing.
Couldn't agree more, but it is not for everybody, right? It is a super dense, fast paced moving environment. And that does not sit with everybody's nervous system.
Yeah. You invest with social leverage. How do you think we compare to other people that you invest with, just top of your head?
This
that's advertising. Probably can't have that in. I was just kidding around. So you show up at our events, which is what I was just kidding, was what's important. And you feel part of the community,
yeah.
Right? And I think that's part of
I get this question not necessarily from you, but from other people a lot. Like why are you invested there? And consistently you and the social leverage team give me access to something that I don't have ready access to otherwise, and that is the blend of technology and finance. I'm fascinated by the finance world, but I know very little about it. It's hard for me to understand it. It's hard for me to play in that space, and social leverage gives me an opportunity to do precisely that. And so attending the events, I get to chat with people in a million years I would never chat with, and I'm always blown away. Always blown away.
But yet, honey and Gnip were really financial products.
Gnip had...
At the highest level, they were high margin of everything that fintech promised. I have to say this out loud a lot these days because, you know, for all my work, there's just a lot of low margin, degenerate type products that were created. I'm proud of all the investments because we're seed investors. We don't know what things will become when you plant a seed, right? Like how you water it, how you nurture it, what the environment is around it, blah, 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 blah. But if we look back at finance 2.0, it's the same fucking thing. So we got Bitcoin, Gensler doesn't want it. We've got Robinhood, but tiny company relative to like the Schwabs and E-Trades and TD Ameritrades. You know, jury's still out. We have so many failed low margin lending fintech companies. But yet Honey and Gnip were very high margin fintech products, right? The banks paid for Gnip. And in Honey, the consumer, that's a fintech product. You save consumers money and built a profitable business with a good exit.
Yeah. So, but that's business always distills down to finance on some level. So those were finance related businesses, but they weren't inherently financial industry at the core. Or, you know, Honey arguably was, but it was consumer focused as opposed to.
But from finance, I know because you've dabbled in, you love playing around with Robinhood and the options and your kids.
Yep.
So it's like these tools are there and we just haven't gone to the next level.
Right.
Them. Could be sports gambling that gets everybody over the hump. What has you excited in tinkering today? Is it AI?
Lightly tinkering there myself. That said, I'm most excited about what AI is going to bring. It's current incarnation that we're all excited about. I think is a blip that will be footnoted in terms of its actual total impact. I think we're all just kind of enamored with this new way to interact with the machine.
Machines.
And it's fun. Like, you know, really excited
about
that. Yeah,
the UI works.
Yeah, the UI works. It's really fun. It's got lots of problems. I do worry we're just at the moment going to overlay existing known models onto it. I worry that the Web 2 headspace is going to try to graft onto ChatGPT and the existing AI interface, which it will do. That is totally uninteresting to me. I think the real power of AI will be seen in completely different models and completely different frameworks, like healthcare, infrastructure,
education.
Like the application of that technology on those really hard problems is
law, accounting.
That is where humanity is going to shift, and we're not. That hasn't reached full deployment. Not even close. As consumers, we haven't even really seen.
But it's organic, which is nice.
Yeah, totally.
The UI makes it organic where an 8-year-old or an 80-year-old can use it.
Totally. And it's incredible, right? Chatting with a machine that has that much knowledge is really powerful. We do one word of caution for everyone out there doing it, playing with it. Depending on how you're using it, you've got to watch out for hallucinations.
What does that mean?
The machine will conjure up content and purport that it is, or it will come across as factual, but it's actually not. You know, they will often, the algorithm will infer that if A, B, and C were true, then D would likely be true. And it will put D down as fact for you as the human consuming the content. There's got to be a lot of fact checking in there as you're generating content, you know.
And what is it that your son likes about engineering?
This is his first year. I think he's trying to figure that out. You know, he's kind of split right now. He's actually been interning for an AI related company over the past few months while doing his core CS classes. So he's kind of seeing this split between core baseline data structures, discrete structures, algorithms, computer science coursework vis-a-vis the wave of AI that is crashing down upon us. And I think he's in the midst of trying to evaluate what's notable and what's interesting. There was several layers removed from me. Old acquaintance said something interesting on, I think it was LinkedIn. Prompt engineer is the new software engineer.
Correct.
And
Yoni said that to me too in Israel. He's like, dude, my best coders will code differently.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's grappling with that phrase as we speak. Am I a software engineer? Am I a prompt engineer? What does it mean? How do they relate? So TBD.
TBD. Well, I like that. I'm going to let you go. What a treat.
Yeah, good to see you.
For you, I mean. Yeah. For me, I just put up with that. For you, what a treat this
must be. That's like twice.
You have one of the best laughs in tech, too.
So, I do?
Yeah, I think you
do. I'll take that.
It's a very natural laugh. There's no bullshitting Judd Valesky.
No, all natural.
What a treat. Thanks for, you don't do this that often, but the track record speaks for itself.
It was fun.
And
good to see you twice in as many weeks.
Twice in as many weeks, and we will check in you. I'm running to you soon, my man. So have a fantastic summer.
Likewise. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Ethan Knut.
Hey.
See? Quiet legends out there.
That was a good one.
As compared to most that aren't good ones.
Good point.
The tech has only been around, it's been around 40, 50 years, I guess. In the 70s, when we started getting the first inklings of what the internet would be, probably, but semiconductors. But, you know, when you get someone that's been that ground level across 20 years of this, pretty good. They can speak English. Ohm is like that, but not as maybe the entrepreneurial side. and then just to actually have an exit to Twitter and then go be involved in a $4 billion exit right after, bing, bang, boom, and have your kids now going in talented design and engineering. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool guy because he's very humble about the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's fun, and he breaks it down in English.
No BS.
No BS, which is kind of our LP base. We have guys like Judd, which yep. are kind of no BS guys that we fill in. And that's what part of our secret sauce is having people around the table that we can send stuff like this to. We see a lot of these, mm-hmm. you know, because of Honey, we see hundreds of these things. And it's always nice if we think it's interesting to send it to Judd and say, Judd, this has got potential. And use that network to get quick answers. Anyways, you were listening to Panic with Friends, where I have on guests, founders, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, traders, trying to get a little bit ahead of the market. You can search my name, Howard Lindzen, or go to Panic with Friends, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Google, and you will subscribe on one of those, your favorite, and you will get something once a week from us, never a hassle. Tell your friends, please do subscribe, and we'll see everybody next week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.